It is a place of beauty and terror beyond what can be imagined here. I have ridden with the Wild Hunt. I have carved a clear path of freedom among the stars and outrun the wind. And now I am asked to walk upon the earth again. You belong where you're loved, Emma said. It was something her father had said, something she had always believed. She belonged here because Jules loved her and the children loved her. Were you loved in Faerie? A shadow seemed to come down over Mark's eyes, like curtains closing in a dark room. I meant to tell you, I'm sorry about your parents. Emma waited for the familiar burn of sickening rage that the mention of her parents by anyone but Jules always brought on, but it didn't come. There was something in the way he said it, something about the strange mixture of formal, fairy speech and sincere regret that was oddly calming. And I'm sorry about your father, she told him. I saw him turned, Mark said, though I did not see him die in the dark war. I hope he did not suffer. Emma felt a ripple of shock pass up her spine. Did he not know how his father had died? Had no one told him? She began. It was in the middle of the battle. It was very quick. You saw it? Emma scrambled to her feet. It's late, she said. We should get to sleep. He looked up at her with his eerie eyes. You do not want to sleep, he said. And he looked wild to her suddenly, wild as the stars of the desert, wild as all natural, untamed things. You've always been one for adventure, Emma, and I do not think that has died in you, has it? Tied, though you might be, to my unadventurous little brother. Julian isn't unadventurous, Emma said angrily. He's responsible. You would have me believe there's a difference? Emma looked up at the moon and then back at Mark. What are you suggesting? It occurred to me as I looked out at the ocean, he said. I may be able to find the place where the ley lines converge. I've seen such places before with the Hunt. They give off a certain energy that fey folk can feel. What? But how? I'll show you. Come with me to look for the place. Why wait? The investigation is urgent, isn't it? We must find the killer. Excitement rose up in Emma and sharp desire. She tried to keep it off her face. How badly she wanted, needed to know, to take the next step, to throw herself into searching, fighting, finding. Jules, she said, rising to her feet, we have to get Jules and bring him. Mark looked grim. I do not wish to see him. Emma stood her ground. Then we don't go, she said. He's my parabatai. Where I go, he goes. Something flashed in Mark's eyes. If you won't go without him, we will not go at all, he said. You cannot force me to give up the information. Force you? Mark. Emma broke off, exasperated. Fine, we can go, just us. Just us, he repeated. He stood up. His movements were impossibly light and fast. But first, you must prove yourself. He stepped off the roof. Emma skidded to the edge of the shingle and leaned out. There was Mark, clinging to the wall of the Institute, an arm's length below her. He looked up with a fierce grin. A grin that spoke of empty air and cold wind, the torn surface of the ocean, the ragged edge of clouds. A grin that beckoned to the wild, unbound side of Emma, the side that dreamed of fire and battle and blood and vengeance. "Climb down with me," he said. And now there was an edge of mockery in his voice. "You're crazy," she hissed. But he had already begun to move down the wall, using handholds and footholds that Emma couldn't even see. The ground swung under her. Real heights. If she fell from the roof of the Institute, she might well die. There was no assurance in Arazi would save her. She got down on her knees and turned her back to the ocean. She slid down, her nails scraping shingle, and then she was clinging to the gutter with her hands, her legs dangling out into the air. She scrabbled at the wall with her bare feet. Thank the angel she wasn't wearing boots. Her feet were calloused from walking and fighting. They slipped along the wall until they found a crack in the surface. She jammed her toes into it, relieving the weight on her arms. Don't look down. For as long as Emma could remember, the voice in her head that calmed her panic had been Jules. She heard it now, bringing her hands down, her fingers jamming into the space between two stones. She lowered herself down, an inch at first, then farther as she found another foothold. She heard Jules. You're climbing over the rocks at Leo Carrillo. It's only a few feet down to soft sand. Everything's safe. The wind blew her hair across her face. She turned her head to shake it out of her eyes and realized she was passing a window. Pale light burned behind the curtains. Christina's room, maybe? Have you always been this careless? More since the Dark War. She was halfway down now, she guessed from looking up, the roof receding. She had started to speed up, her fingertips and toes swiftly discovering new handholds and footholds. The plaster in between the stones helped, kept her sweaty hands from slipping as she gripped and released, pressing her body hard against the wall until suddenly she was reaching down with her foot and struck solid ground. She let go and fell, landing with a soft puff of sand. They were on the east side of the house, facing the garden, the small parking area, and the desert beyond. Mark was already there, of course, bleached by moonlight and looking like part of the desert, a curious carving of pale new stone. Emma was breathing hard as she stepped away from the wall, but it was with exhilaration. Her heart was hammering, her blood drumming. She could taste salt on the wind in her mouth. Mark rocked backward, hands in his pockets. "Come with me," he whispered, and turned away from the building toward the sand and scrub of the desert. "Wait," Emma said. Mark stopped and looked over his shoulder at her. "Weapons," she said, "and shoes." She went to the car. A quick open rune unlocked the trunk, revealing piles of weapons and gear. She hunted until she found a belt and a spare pair of boots. She buckled the belt on quickly, slammed some blades and daggers into it, grabbed up some spares, and kicked her feet into the boots. Luckily, in the rush back from Malcolm's, she'd left Cortana strapped to the inside of the trunk. She freed the blade and slung it over her back before hurrying over to Mark, who silently accepted her offer of a serif blade and a set of knives before gesturing for her to follow him. Behind the low wall bordering the parking lot was the rock garden, usually peaceful, planted with cacti and dotted here and there with plaster statues of classical heroes placed there by Arthur. He'd had them shipped from England when he'd first moved to the Institute, and they stuck out among the cacti, anomalous. There was something else there now, a dark hulking shadow covered by a cloth. Mark moved toward it, again with that odd smile. Emma stepped aside to let him go ahead of her, and he plucked the long black cloth away. Beneath it was a motorcycle. Emma gave a little gasp. It wasn't any make of motorcycle that she knew. It was silvery white, as if it had been carved out of bone. It glimmered under the moonlight, and Emma almost thought for a moment she could see through it, the way she sometimes saw through glamours, to a shape beneath, with a tossing mane and wide eyes. When you take a steed from fairy, whose substance is magic, its nature can change to suit the mundane world, said Mark, smiling at her, stunned expression.
You mean this was once a horse? This is a pony cycle? Emma demanded, forgetting to whisper. His smile broadened.
There are many sorts of steeds who ride with the wild hunt.
Emma was already beside the motorcycle, running her hands over it. The metal felt smooth like glass, cool under her fingers, milk-white and glowing. She had wanted to ride a motorcycle all her life. Jason Clary had ridden a flying motorcycle. There were paintings of it.
Does it fly?
Mark nodded, and she was lost.
I want to drive it, she said. I want to drive it myself.
He swept an elaborate bow.
It was a graceful alien gesture, the kind that might have existed in the court of a king hundreds of years ago.
Then you're welcome to do so.
Julian would kill me, Emma said reflexively, still stroking the machine. Beautiful as it was, she felt a thrill of trepidation at the thought of riding it. It didn't have an exhaust pipe, a speedometer, any of the normal gear she associated with a cycle.
You don't strike me as that easy to kill, Mark said. And now he wasn't smiling. The way he looked at her was direct and challenging. Without another word, Emma swung her leg over the bike. She reached to grip the handlebars, and they seemed to bend inward to fit her hands. She looked at Mark.
Get on behind me, she said, if you want to ride.
She felt the cycle rock under her as he climbed on behind her. His hands clasped her sides lightly.
Emma exhaled, her shoulders tensing. It's alive, Mark whispered. It will respond to you if you will it. Her hands tightened on the handlebars. Fly.
The cycle shot up into the air and Emma screamed, half in shock, half in delight. Mark's hands tightened on her waist as they hurtled up, the ground receding below them. The wind poured around them. Untrammeled by gravity, the cycle shot forward as Emma urged it on, leaning forward to communicate with her body what she wanted it to do. They whipped past the Institute, the road that led down toward the highway opening up under them. They raced along above it, desert wind giving way to salt on Emma's tongue as they reached the Pacific Coast Highway. Cars darting past below them in blaring lines of pale gold headlights. She cried out in delight, wheeling the cycle onward. Faster! Go faster! The beach flew by beneath them. Pale gold sand turned white by starlight, and then they were out over the ocean. The moon lit a silvery path for them. Emma could hear Mark yelling something in her ear, but for the moment there was nothing but the ocean and the cycle under her, the wind whipping her hair back and making her eyes water. And then she looked down. On either side of the moonlit path was the water, navy blue in the darkness. Land was a distant line of brilliant lights, the etched shadow of mountains against the sky. And below was ocean, miles of ocean, and Emma felt the familiar cold of fear, like a block of ice applied suddenly to the back of her neck and spreading through her veins. Miles of ocean, and oh, the vastness of it! Shadows and salt, fierce dark water filled with alien emptiness and the monsters that lived there. Imagine falling into that water and knowing it was below you, even as you treaded water, desperately trying to remain on the surface. The terror of the realization of what was under you. Miles and miles of nothingness and monsters, blackness stretching away everywhere, and the sea floor so far below would tear your mind apart. The cycle jerked under her hands, rebelling. She bit down hard on her lip, summoning blood to the surface, focusing her mind. The cycle slewed around under her hands and shot back toward the beach. Faster, Emma urged it, suddenly desperate to have dry land under them. She thought she could see shadows moving under the skin of the sea. She thought of old stories of sailors whose boats were lifted out of the water on the backs of whales and sea monsters. Small craft torn apart by sea demons, their crews fed to the sharks. She caught her breath, the cycle jumping under her, momentarily losing her grip on the handlebars. They plunged downward. Mark cried out as they shot past the crashing waves and toward the beach. Emma's fingers scrabbled and seized on the handlebars again, her grip tight as the front wheel grazed the sand, and then the bike was rising again, skimming over the beach, lifting to pass over the highway below them. She heard Mark laugh. It was a wild sound. She could hear the echo of the hunt in it, the roar of the horn and the pounding of hooves. She breathed in cool, clear air. Her hair whipped behind her. There were no rules. She was free.
"You have proved yourself, Emma," he said. "You could ride with Gwyn if you chose."
"The wild hunt doesn't allow women," she pointed out, the words torn from her mouth by the wind.
"The more fool they," he said. "Women are fiercer by far than men."
He pointed at the shore toward the ridges of the mountains that ran along the coast. "Go that way. I'll take you to the convergence." 9. Kingdom by the Sea. No wonder Jace Herondale had once jumped at the chance to fly a motorcycle, Emma thought. It was a completely different vantage point on the world. She and Mark followed the line of the highway north, flying over mansions with massive swimming pools that hung out over the ocean. Castles tucked up into canyons and bluffs, dipping down low enough once to see a party going on in someone's backyard, complete with glowing multicolored lanterns. Mark guided her from behind with taps on her wrists. The wind had risen too high for her to hear his voice. They passed over a late-night seafood shack, music and light pouring out of the windows. Emma had been there before and remembered sitting on the big wooden picnic tables with Jules, dunking fried oysters in tartar sauce. Dozens of Harley-Davidsons were parked outside the restaurant, though Emma doubted any of them could fly. She grinned to herself, unable to help it, feeling drunk on the height and the cold air. Mark tapped her right wrist. A smooth stretch of sand spilled from the beach, reaching halfway up high bluffs. Emma tilted the cycle so that they were nearly vertical, hurtling up the side of a cliff. They cleared the lip of the bluff with a foot of space and shot forward, the wheels scraping the tips of the California thistle that grew among the long grass. A granite rise loomed in front of them, a dome-like hill atop the bluffs. Emma leaned back, preparing to gun the cycle, but Mark reached around her, his voice in her ear.
"Stop! Stop!"
The cycle skidded to a halt just as they passed the tangle of weeds that bordered the bluffs. Inside the border of coastal shrubs was a stretch of grass that reached the low granite hill. The grass looked trampled in places, as if it had been walked on, and in the distance, to the right of the grassy stretch, Emma could see a faint dirt road, winding down the bluffs toward the highway. Emma swung herself off the cycle. Mark followed, and they stood for a moment, the sea agleam in the distance, the hill rising dark in front of them.
"You drive too fast," said Mark.
Emma snorted and checked the strap of Cortana where it fastened across her chest. You sound like Julian.
It brought me joy, Mark said, moving to stand beside her. It was as if I flew with the hunt again and tasted the blood of the sky.
Okay, you sound like Julian on drugs, Emma muttered. She glanced around. Where are we? Is this the ley line convergence?
There.
Mark pointed at a dark opening in the rock of the hill. As they moved toward it, Emma reached back to touch the hilt of Cortana. Something about the place was giving her shivers. Maybe it was simply the power of the convergence. But as they neared the cave, and the hair rose on the back of her neck, she doubted it.
The grass is flat, she said, indicating the area around the cave with a sweep of her hand. Trampled. Someone's been walking here, a lot of someone's. But there are no fresh tire tracks on the road.
Mark glanced around, head tilted back, like a wolf scenting the air. His feet were still bare, but he seemed to have no problem walking on the rough ground despite the thistles and sharp rocks visible between the grasses. There was a sharp, bright trill, Emma's phone ringing.
Jules, she thought, and snatched it out of her pocket.
Emma? It was Christina, her low, sweet voice oddly startling, a sharp reminder of reality after the unreal flight through the sky.
Where are you? Did you find Mark?
I found him, Emma said, glancing over toward Mark. He appeared to be examining the plants growing around the mouth of the cave.
We're at the convergence.
What?
Where is it? Is it dangerous?
Not yet, Emma said as Mark ducked into the cave.
Mark! She called. Mark, don't! Mark!
The phone connection dropped. Swearing, Emma stuck the phone back into her pocket and took out her witch light. It came on, soft and bright, raying out through her fingers. It illuminated the mouth of the cave. She headed toward it, cursing Mark under her breath. He was just inside the cave, looking down at more of the same plants, clustering around the dry, soft stone.
Atropa belladonna, he said. It means beautiful lady. It's poisonous.
Emma made a face. Does it grow around here normally?
Not in this quantity.
He reached down to touch it. Emma caught his wrist.
Don't, she said. You said it was poisonous.
Only if swallowed, he said. Hasn't Uncle Arthur taught you anything about the death of Augustus?
Nothing I haven't worked hard to forget.
Mark straightened up, and she let go of him. She flexed her fingers. There was wiry strength in his arms. As he moved forward into the cave, which began to narrow into a tunnel, she couldn't help but remember Mark the last time she had seen him, before he had been taken by Sebastian Morgenstern. Smiling, blue-eyed, short pale hair curling over the tips of his pointed ears. Broad-shouldered, or at least she, at 12, had thought so. Certainly he had been bigger than Julian, taller and broader than all of them, grown up. Now prowling ahead of her, he seemed a feral child, hair gleaming in the witchlight. He moved like a cloud across the sky, vapor at the mercy of wind that could tear it to shreds. He vanished around a bend of rock, and Emma almost closed her eyes against the image of a vanished Mark. He belonged to the past that contained her parents, and you could drown in the past if you let it have you while you were working. And she was a shadow hunter. She was always working.
Emma! Mark called, his voice echoing off the walls. Come and see this!
She hurried after him down the tunnel. It opened out into a circular chamber lined with metal. Emma turned on her heel in a slow circle, staring. She wasn't sure what she had expected, but not something that looked like the inside of an occult ocean liner. The walls were bronze, covered in strange symbols, a scrawled mixture of languages, some demonic, some ancient, but human. She recognized demotic Greek and Latin, a few passages from the Bible. Two massive glass doors like portholes were set into the walls, shut and bolted with rivets. A strange metal ornament had been fixed in the wall between them. Through the glass, Emma could see only surging darkness as if they were underwater. There was no furniture in the room, but a circle of symbols done in chalk was drawn into the smooth black stone floor. Emma brought out her phone and began to take pictures. The flash going off seemed eerie in the dimness. Mark moved toward the circle.
Don't!
Emma lowered her phone. Go in there, she sighed. He was already inside the circle, looking around curiously. Emma couldn't see anything in there with him besides bare floor. Please come out, she said wheedlingly. If there's some magic spell in there and it kills you, explaining to Jules is going to be so awkward. There was a faint shimmer of light as Mark stepped out of the circle. Awkward. Seems like an understatement, he said.
That's the point.
Emma said, that's why it's funny. He looked blank. Never mind.
I read once that explaining a joke is like dissecting a frog, Mark said. You find out how it works, but the frog dies in the process.
Maybe we should get out of here before we die in the process. I took some photos with my phone, so...
I found this, Mark said, and showed her a square leather object. It was inside the circle along with some clothes, and what looked like, he frowned, broken teeth.
Emma snatched the object out of his hand. It was a wallet, a man's wallet, semi-scorched by fire.
I didn't see anything, she said. The circle looked empty.
Glamour spell.
I felt it when I passed through.
She flipped the wallet open and her heart leaped. Pressed behind plastic was a driver's license with a familiar picture, the man whose body she'd found in the alley. There was money in the wallet and credit cards, but her eyes were fixed on the license and his name, Stanley Albert Wells. The same longish grayish hair and round face she remembered, only this time his features weren't twisted and stained with blood. The address under the name had been burned to illegibility, but the birth date and other information were clear.
Mark! Mark! She waved the wallet over her head. This is a clue, an actual clue. I think I love you.
Mark's eyebrows went up.
In fairy, if you said that, we would have to pledge our troth, and you might put a gesh upon me that I would not stray from you or I would die.
Emma shoved the wallet in her pocket.
Well, here it's just an expression that means I like you very much, or even thanks for the blood-stained wallet.
How specific you humans are.
You're human, Mark Blackthorne.
A sound echoed through the room. Mark jerked his gaze from hers and raised his head. Emma almost imagined his pointed ears twitching toward the sound and suppressed a smile.
Outside, he said, there's something outside.
Her incipient smile disappeared. She slipped into the tunnel, sliding her witchlight into her pocket to douse the illumination. Mark fell into step behind her as she drew out her steely with her left hand, scrawling a number of quick runes onto her arms. Sure strike, swift-footedness, battle rage, soundless. She turned to Mark as they neared the entrance, her steely out, but he shook his head.
No. No runes.
She flipped the steely back into her belt. They had reached the mouth of the cave. The air was cooler here, and she could see the sky dotted with stars, and the grass silvery in the moonlight. The field in front of the cave looked bare and empty. Emma could see nothing but grass and thistles, pounded flat as if by the tread of boots, reaching all the way to the edge of the bluff. There was a sharp musical sound in the air, like the buzz of insects. She heard Mark's sharp intake of breath behind her. Light flared as he spoke.
Remiel!
His seraph blade blazed to life. As if the light had ripped away a glamour, suddenly she could see them, whistling and chittering among the long grass. Demons. She whipped Cortana free so quickly it was as if it had leaped into her hand. There were dozens of them, spread between the cave and the bluff. They looked like enormous insects, praying mantises to be precise. Triangular heads, elongated bodies, massive grasping arms ridged with blades of chitin sharp as razors. Their eyes were pallid, flat, and milky. They were between her and Mark and the motorcycle.
Manted demons, Emma whispered. We can't fight all of them.
She looked up at Mark, his face illuminated by Remiel.
We have to get to the cycle.
Mark nodded.
Go, he said.
Emma sprang forward. It came down like a cage the moment her boots hit the grass, a wave of cold that seemed to slow time. She saw one of the manteds turn toward her, lashing out with grasping, spiked forelegs. She bent her knees and sprang, rising into the air as she slashed downward, severing the manted's head from its body. Green ichor sprayed. She landed on soaked ground as the demon's body folded up and vanished, sucked back to its home dimension. A flicker rose in her peripheral vision. She spun and struck out again, jamming the point of Cortana into another manted's thorax. She jerked her sword back, struck again, watched the demon crumble around the blade. Her heart was beating in her ears. This was the sharp point of the blade, the moment when all the training, all the hours and the passion and the rage narrowed down to a single point of focus and determination. Killing demons. That was what mattered. Mark was easily visible, his seraph blade lighting up the grass around him. He slashed out at a manted, severing its forelegs. It wobbled, chittering, still alive. Mark's face twisted with disgust. Emma ran toward a heap of rocks, darted up the side, and sailed down, slicing the crippled manted in half. It vanished as she landed in front of Mark.
That was mine to dispatch, he said with a cold look.
Trust me, Emma said, there's plenty. She grabbed him with her free hand and spun him around. Five mantids were lurching toward them from cracks in the granite hill.
"Kill those," she said. "I'll get the cycle."
Mark leaped forward with a cry like a hunting horn. He cut at the mantids' legs and forelegs, crippling them. They fell around him, spraying green-black ichor. It stank like burning gasoline. Emma began to run for the bluff. Demons surged up at her as she went. She slashed at where they were weakest. The connective tissue where the chitin was thin, severing heads from thoraxes, legs from bodies. Her jeans and cardigan were wet with demon blood. She skidded around a dying mantid, slid toward the edge of the bluff, and froze. A mantid was lifting the cycle in its forelegs. She could swear it was grinning at her, its triangular head splitting open to reveal rows of needle teeth as it clamped razored forelegs around the cycle, crushing it to pieces. Metal screamed and rent, tires popped, and the mantid chittered in joy as the machine came apart, the pieces hurtling down the side of the bluff, taking with it Emma's hope of an easy escape. She glared at the mantid. "That," she said, "was a really sweet ride," and catching up a knife from her belt, she threw it. It jammed into the mantid's body, severing thorax from prothorax. Ichor sprayed from the demon's mouth as it tipped backwards, spasming, its body following the cycle down the cliffside. "Jerk," Emma muttered, whirling back toward the field. She hated using throwing knives to kill an enemy, mostly because you were unlikely to get them back. She had three more in her belt, a Seraph blade and Cortana. She knew it wasn't nearly enough to take on the 24 mantids still prowling the grass, but it was what she had. It would have to do. She could see Mark, who had climbed the face of the granite hill and was perched on an outcropping, stabbing downward with his blade. She began to run toward him. She dodged a lashing foreleg, arcing Cortana up to sever the limb as she ran. She heard the mantid shriek in pain. One of the taller mantids was reaching up toward Mark, jagged forelegs grasping. He brought Remuel down, hard, severing its head, and as it collapsed, a second mantid appeared, its jaws biting down on the blade. It fell back, shrieking its high insect shriek. It was dying, but it had taken Remuel with it. They subsided together into a sizzling puddle of ichor and adamus. Mark had used all the weapons Emma had given him. He pressed his back against the granite as another mantid reached out. Emma's heart lurched into her throat. She raced forward, flinging herself at the wall, scrambling toward Mark. A massive mantid loomed up in front of him. He reached for his throat as the mantid leaned in, jaws gaping, and Emma wanted to scream at him to back down, back away. Something shone between his fingers, a silver chain, gleaming, arrowhead dangling. He whipped it forward toward the head of the mantid, slashing open its bulging white eyes. Milky fluid burst forth. It reared back, screaming, just as Emma leaped to the ridge beside Mark and slashed Cortana forward to cut it in half. Mark dropped the chain back over his head as Emma swore and pressed her only Seraph blade into his hand. Ichor was running down the blade of Cortana, burning her skin. She gritted her teeth and ignored the pain as Mark raised his new blade. "Name it," she said, breathing hard, pulling a knife from her belt. She clutched it in her right hand, Cortana in her left. Mark nodded. "Ragel," he said, and the blade exploded with light. The mantid screeched, crouching down, wincing away from the glow, and Emma leaped from the rock. She fell, whipping Cortana and the dagger around herself like the blades of a helicopter. The air was filled with insectile screeches as her weapons connected with chitin and flesh. The world had slowed. She was still falling. She had all the time in the world. She reached out, left hand and right hand, severing head from thorax, mesothorax from metathorax, hacking through the jaws of two mantids to leave them drowning in their own blood. A foreleg reached for her. She slashed through it with an angled twist of Cortana. When she hit the ground, six mantid bodies tumbled after her, each landing with a dull thud and vanishing. Only the foreleg remained, sticking into the ground like a strange cactus plant. The remaining mantids were circling, hissing and clicking, but not yet attacking. They seemed wary, as if even their tiny bug brains had noted the fact that she was a danger to them. One of them was missing its foreleg. She glanced toward Mark. He was still balanced on the rock, outcropping. She couldn't blame him. It made an excellent fixed position to fight from. As she watched, a mantid lunged toward him, swiping a razored limb across his chest. He brought Ragel down, stabbing into its abdomen. It roared, staggering back. In the bright light of the Seraph blade, Emma saw blood bloom across Mark's shirt, red-black. "Mark," she whispered. He spun gracefully. His Seraph blade cut the mantid apart. It fell into two pieces, vanishing just as the night exploded with light. A car burst from the road and hurtled into the center of the clearing. A familiar red Toyota, The headlights burned through the darkness, sweeping across the field, illuminating the mantids. A figure knelt on the car's roof, a light crossbow raised to its shoulder. Julian. The car shot forward, and Julian rose to his feet, lifting the crossbow. It was an intricate weapon, Julian's crossbow, capable of firing multiple bolts fast. He pivoted toward the demons, firing off a bolt, then another, all the while riding the roof of the car like a surfboard, his feet firmly planted as the Toyota bumped and hurtled over the rough ground. Pride swelled in Emma. People often acted as if Julian couldn't be a warrior because he was gentle in his life, gentle to his friends and family. People were wrong. Each bolt connected, each sank home into the body of a demon. The bolts were ruined. As they struck, the mantids exploded with silent screams. The car screeched through the clearing. Emma saw Christina at the wheel, her jaw set. The mantid demons were scattering, vanishing back into the shadows. Christina gunned the engine, and the car rammed into several of them, mashing them flat. Mark leaped off the rock, landing in a crouch, and dispatched a twitching, spasming demon, grinding his blade into its anvil-shaped head and smearing it across the grass. The front of his shirt was dark with blood. As the demon vanished with a wet, sticky sound, Mark collapsed to his knees, his serif blade tumbling into the grass beside him. The car jerked to a halt. Christina had flung the driver's door open when one of the mantids slithered out from under the wheels of the car. It bounded toward Mark. Julian shouted aloud, leaping down from the car. The mantid reared up over Mark, who shoved himself up on his knees, reaching for the chain around his neck. Energy poured through Emma like a jolt of caffeine, Julian's presence making her stronger. She jerked the severed foreleg out of the ground in front of her and flung it. It whipped through the air, spinning like a propeller, and punched into the body of the mantid with a thick smack. The demon shrieked in agony and disappeared in a cloud of ichor. Mark sank back into the grass. Julian was bending over him, Emma already running. Jules had his Sealy out. "Mark," he said as Emma reached them. "Mark, please." "No," Mark said thickly. He batted away his brother's hands. "No runes." He dragged himself to his knees, then his feet, and stood swaying. "No runes, Julian." He glanced toward Emma. "Are you all right?" "I'm fine," Emma said, sheathing Cortana. The coldness of battle had faded away, leaving her feeling lightheaded. In the moonlight, Julian's eyes were a coldly burning blue. He was in gear, his dark hair a mess from the wind, his right hand clasping the stock of his crossbow. He put his other hand up to her face. Her gaze felt dragged up to his. She could see the night sky in his pupils. "Fine?" he echoed, and his voice was rough. "You're bleeding." He lowered his arm. His fingers were red. Her free hand sprang to her cheek. She felt the ragged cut, the blood, the sting. "I didn't realize," she said, and then the words spilling out. How did you find us? Jules, how did you know where to go?" Before Julian could answer, the Toyota backed up with a roar, spun around, and drove back toward them. Christina leaned out the driver's side window, her medallion gleaming at her throat. "Let's go," she said. "It's dangerous here." "The demons have not gone," Mark agreed. "They've only retreated." He wasn't wrong. The night around them was alive with moving shadows. They clambered hastily into the car. Emma beside Christina, Julian and Mark in the back seat. As the car sped away from the cave, Emma reached into her cardigan pocket, feeling for the hard square of leather. The wallet, it was still there. She felt a burst of relief. She was here, in the car, with Julian beside her and evidence in her hand. Everything was all right. "You need an Arazi," said Julian. "Mark, stay away from me with that thing," said his brother in a low, intent voice, glaring at Julian and the Sealy in his hand, "or I will leap from the window of this moving vehicle."
"Oh, no, you won't," said Christina in her calm, sweet voice, reaching to depress the button that locked all the car doors with a firm click.
"You're bleeding," said Julian, "all over the car." Emma craned around in her seat to look back at them. Mark's shirt was bloody, but he didn't seem to be in much pain. His eyes flickered with annoyance. "I'm still protected by the magic of the Wild Hunt," he said. "My wounds heal quickly. You need not trouble yourself." He picked up the edge of his shirt, mopped at the blood on his chest. Emma caught a quick glimpse of pale skin stretched tightly over a hard stomach and the edges of old scars. "It's a good thing you showed up when you did," Emma said, turning to look at Christina and then Julian. "I don't know how you figured out what was going on, but..."
"We didn't," Julian said shortly.
"After you hung up on Christina, we checked your phone's GPS and realized you were out here. It seemed weird enough to follow up."
"But you didn't know we were in trouble," Emma realized. "Just that we were at the convergence."
Christina gave her an expressive look. Julian didn't say anything. Emma unzipped her cardigan and shrugged out of it, transferring Wells' wallet to the pocket of her jeans. Battle brought on a sort of numbness, a lack of awareness of injury that let her go forward. The aches and pains were coming now, and she winced as she peeled her sleeve away from her forearm. A long burn reached from her elbow to her wrist, red-black at the edges. She glanced up at the rearview mirror and saw Jules registering the injury. He leaned forward.
"Can you pull over here, Christina?"
Unfailingly polite, Jules. Emma tried to smile at him in the mirror, but he wasn't looking at her. Christina pulled off the highway and into the parking lot of the seafood shack Emma and Mark had flown over earlier. A massive neon sign reading Poseidon's Trident hung over the ramshackle building. The four of them piled out of the car. The shack was nearly deserted except for a few tables of long-distance truckers and campers from the sites down the road, huddling over coffee and plates of fried oysters. Christina insisted on going inside to order them some food and drinks. After a moment's argument, they let her. Julian threw his jacket on a table, claiming it. "There's an outdoor shower around the back," he said, "and some privacy. Come on."
"How do you know that?" Emma asked, joining him as he stalked around the building.
He didn't answer. She could feel his anger, not just in the way he looked at her, but in the tight knot under her ribcage. The dirt path that circled the shack opened out into an area ringed by dumpsters. There was a massive steel double sink and, as Jules promised, a large open shower with surfing equipment stacked next to it. Mark crossed the sand to the shower and flipped the spigot.
"Wait," Julian began. "You'll get..."
Water poured down, soaking Mark instantly. He lifted his face up to it as calmly as if he were bathing in tropical rainfall and not unheated shower water on a chilly night.
"Wet."
Julian raked his fingers through his tangled hair. Chocolate-colored hair, Emma had thought when she was younger. People thought brown hair was boring, but it wasn't. Julian's had bits of gold in it and hints of russet and coffee. Emma went to the sink and ran water over the cut on her arm, then splashed it up over her face and neck, rinsing off the ichor. Demon blood was toxic. It could burn your skin, and it was a bad idea to get it into your mouth and eyes. Mark flipped the shower off and stepped away, water streaming off him. She wondered if he was uncomfortable. His jeans stuck to him, as did his shirt. His hair was plastered to his neck. His eyes met hers, cold burning blue and colder gold. In them, Emma saw the wildness of the hunt, the emptiness and freedom of the skies. It made her shiver. She saw Julian look at her sharply. He said something to Mark, who nodded and vanished around the side of the building. Emma reached to turn the sink water off, wincing. There was a burn on her palm. She reached for her sealy.
"Don't," said Jules' voice, and there was a warm presence behind her suddenly.
She gripped the edge of the sink and closed her eyes, feeling momentarily dizzy. The heat of Jules' body was palpable, up and down her back.
"Let me."
Healing runes, any runes, given to you by your parabatai worked better, amplified by the magic of the bonding spell. Emma turned around, her back against the sink. Julian was so close to her that she had to turn carefully so as not to bump into him. He smelled of fire and cloves and paint. Goosebumps exploded across her skin as he took her arm, cupping her wrist, drawing his steely with his free hand. She could feel the path each of his fingers traced on the sensitive skin of her forearm. His skin was hard with calluses, roughened with turpentine.
"Jules," she said, "I'm sorry."
"Sorry for what?"
"Going to the Convergence without you," she said. "I wasn't trying to..."
"Why did you?" he asked, and the steely began its journey over her skin, forming the lines of the healing rune. "Why go off with just Mark?"
"The motorcycle," Emma said.
"It could only take two."
"The motorcycle," she said again at Julian's blank look,
and remembered the mantid demon crushing it in its jagged, razored arms.
"Right," she said.
"Mark's seed? The one the fairy convoy was talking about in the sanctuary? It was a motorcycle. One of the mantids crushed it. So, I guess it's an ex-motorcycle." The Arazi was finished. Emma drew her hand back, watching as the cut began to heal itself, closing up like a seam.
"You're not even wearing gear," Julian said. He sounded quiet, intent, but his fingers were trembling as he put his steely away.
"You're still human, Emma."
"I was fine."
"You can't do this to me." The words sounded as if they had been dredged up from the bottom of the ocean. She froze.
"Do what?"
"I'm your parabatai," he said, as if the words were final, and in a way they were. "You were facing down, what, 2 dozen mantid demons before we got there?
If Christina hadn't called you, I would have fought them off, Emma said heatedly. I'm glad you showed up, thank you. But I would have gotten us out of there. Maybe, his voice rose.
Maybe you would have. Maybe you could have done it. But what if you didn't?
What if you died? It would kill me, Emma. It would kill me. You know what happens.
He didn't finish the sentence. You know what happens to someone when their parabatai dies. They stood staring at each other, breathing hard.
When you were away, I felt it here, Emma said finally, touching her upper arm where the parabatai rune was etched. Did you feel it? She splayed her hand over the front of his t-shirt, warm from his body. Julian's rune was at the outside edge of his collarbone, about 5 inches above his heart.
Yeah, he said, eyelashes lowering as his gaze traced the movement of her fingers. It hurt me being away from you. It feels like there's a hook dug in under my ribs, and there's something pulling at the other end, like I'm tethered to you no matter the distance.
Emma inhaled sharply. She was remembering Julian, 14 years old, in the overlapping circles of fire in the silent city, where the parabatai ritual was performed. The look on his face as they each stepped into the central circle, and the fire rose up around them, and he unbuttoned his shirt to let her touch the sealy to his skin and carve the rune that would bind them together for their whole lives. She knew if she just moved her hand now, she could touch the rune cut into his chest, the rune she had put there. She reached out and touched his collarbone. She could feel the warmth of his skin through his shirt. He half-closed his eyes as if her touch hurt.
Please don't be angry, Jules, she thought. Please.
I'm not a blackthorn, she said, her voice ragged.
What?
I'm not a blackthorn, she said again. The words hurt to say. They came from a deep place of truth, one she hesitated to look at too closely. I don't belong in the Institute. I'm there because of you, because I'm your parabatai. So they had to let me stay. The rest of you don't have to prove you're giving back. I do. Everything I do is a test.
Julian's face had changed. He was looking down at her in the moonlight, the cupid's bow of his lips parted. His hands came up and gently looped her upper arms. Sometimes she thought it was as if she were a kite and Julian the flyer. She soared above the ground and he kept her tethered to the earth. Without him, she would be lost among the clouds. She lifted her head. She could feel his breath on her face. There was something in his eyes, something breaking open, not like a crack in a wall, but like a door swinging wide, and she could see the light.
I'm not testing you, Emma, he said. You've proved everything to me already.
There was a wild feeling in Emma's blood, the desire to seize Julian, to do something, something, crush his hands in hers, put her arms around him, cause them both pain, make them both taste the same seeking desperation. She couldn't understand it, and it terrified her.
She moved aside, gently breaking Julian's hold on her.
We should get back to Mark and Christina, she murmured. It's been a while.
She turned away from him, but not before she saw the expression on his face shut, a slamming door. She felt it like a hollow in her stomach, the intractable certainty that no matter how many demons she had killed that night, her nerve had failed her when she needed it most.
When they got back to the front of the restaurant, they found Mark and Christina seated on top of a picnic table, surrounded by cardboard boxes of French fries, buttered rolls, fried clams, and fish tacos. Christina was holding a bottle of lime soda and smiling at something Mark had said. The wind off the ocean had dried Mark's hair, the blue around his face, highlighting how much he looked like a fairy and how little he seemed like Nephilim.
Mark was telling me about the fight at the convergence point, said Christina as Emma clambered onto the table and reached for a fry. Julian climbed up after her and snagged a soda. Emma launched into her own version of events, from their discovery of the cave and the wallet to the appearance of the manted demons.
They crushed Mark's motorcycle so he couldn't get away, she said.
Mark looked glum.
Thy steed is no more, methinks, Emma said to him.
Will they get you another one?
Unlikely, said Mark. The fair folk are not generous. Julian looked at Emma with his eyebrows raised.
Methinks, he echoed.
I can't help it, she shrugged. It's catching.
Christina held out a hand.
Let's see what you found, she said, since you sacrificed so much to get it.
Emma pulled a square leather object from her pocket and let them all pass it around. Next, she retrieved her phone and held it out while she flipped through the photos of the inside of the cave with the odd languages scrawled on the walls.
"We can translate the Greek and Latin," said Emma, "but we'll need to hit the library for the other languages."
"Stanley Wells," said Julian, looking through the half-burned wallet. "Name sounds familiar."
"When we get back, Ty and Livy can find out who he is," Emma said, "and we can figure out his address, see if there's anything to find at his house, see if there's a reason he might have been targeted for sacrifice."
"It could be randomly chosen," said Julian.
"They are not," said Mark. They all paused, Julian with a bottle halfway to his mouth.
"What?" Emma said.
"Not everyone makes a fit subject to be sacrificed for a summoning spell," said Mark. "It cannot be completely random."
"They teach you much about dark magic in the Wild Hunt?" Julian asked.
"The Wild Hunt is dark magic," said Mark. "I recognize a circle in the cave." He tapped Emma's phone. "This is a sacrificial circle. This is necromancy, the power of death harnessed to some purpose."
They were all quiet for a moment. The cold wind off the ocean ruffled Emma's damp hair.
"The mantids were guards," she said finally. "Whoever the necromancer is doesn't want anyone finding the secret ceremonial chamber."
"Because he needs it," said Jules.
"It could be a she," said Emma. "It isn't just men who get to be psychomagic serial killers."
"Granted," said Julian. "Either way, there's nowhere else near the city with a ley line convergence like this. Necromancy that was done at a ley line extension would probably show up on Magnus's map. But what if it was done at a convergence?"
"Then it might well be hidden from the Nephilim," said Mark.
"The killer could be doing the ceremonial killings at the convergence point."
"And then dumping the bodies at the ley line extensions?" finished Christina.
"But why? Why not leave them in the cave?"
"Perhaps they want the bodies to be found," said Mark. "After all, the marks on them are writing. It could be a message they want to communicate."
"Then they should have written the message in the language we know," Emma muttered.
"Maybe the message isn't for us," said Mark.
"The convergence will have to be watched," said Christina. "Someone will have to monitor it. There's no other convergence point. The murder will have to come back at some point."
"Agreed," Julian said.
"We'll need to set up something at the convergence, something that'll warn us."
"Tomorrow during the day," Emma said, "the manta demons ought to be inactive."
Julian laughed. "You know what we have tomorrow?"
"Testing," he said.
Twice a year, Diana was required to test them on certain basics, from rune drawing to training to languages, and report back to the clave on their progress. There was a chorus of protest. Julian held his hands up. "I'll text Diana about it," he said. "But if we don't do it, the clave will get suspicious."
Mark said something unrepeatable about what the clave could do with its suspicions.
"I don't think I know that word," Christina said, looking amused.
"I'm not sure I do either," said Emma. "And I know a lot of bad words."
Mark leaned back with the beginning of a smile, then sucked in his breath. He pulled his bloody shirt collar away from his neck and glanced down gingerly at his injured chest. Julian set his bottle down.
"Let me see."
Mark let go of his collar.
"There's nothing you can do. It will heal."
"It's a demon injury," said Julian. "Let me see it." Mark looked at him, startled. The waves made a soft, soughing sound around them. There was no one left outside the restaurant except them. The other tables had emptied. Mark hadn't heard that voice of Julian's before, Emma thought. The one that brooked no argument. The one that sounded like a grown man's. The kind of man you listen to. Mark lifted the front of his shirt. The cut ran jaggedly across his chest. It was no longer bleeding, but the sight of the ragged, pale flesh made Emma grit her teeth.
"Let me," Julian began.
Mark sprang off the table.
"I am fine," he said. "I do not need your healing magic. I do not need your runes of safety."
He touched his shoulder, where a black mark bloomed like a butterfly, a permanent rune of protection. "I have had this since I was 10," he said. "I had this when they took me, and this when they broke me, and made me one of them. Never has it helped me. The runes of the angel are lies cast into the teeth of heaven." Hurt bloomed and faded in Julian's eyes.
"They're not perfect," he said. "Nothing is perfect. But they do help. I just don't want to see you hurt."
"Mark," Christina said in a soft voice. But Mark had gone somewhere else, somewhere where none of their voices could reach him. He stood with his eyes blazing, his hands opening and closing into fists. Slowly his hand came up, caught the hem of his shirt, pulled it up and over his head. He shrugged the shirt off, dropping it to the sand. Emma saw pale skin, much paler than hers, a hard chest and a narrow waist cut with the fine lines of old scars. Then he turned around. His back was covered in runes from nape to waist, but not like a normal shadow hunter's, where the black marks faded eventually to a thin white line against the skin. They were raised and thick and livid. Julian had gone white around the mouth.
What?
When I first came to Faerie, they mocked me for my Nephilim blood, Mark said. The folk of the Unseelie court took my steely and broke it, and said it was nothing but a dirty stick. And when I fought back for it, they used knives to cut the angel's runes into my skin. After that, I stopped fighting with them about shadow hunters, and I swore no other rune would touch my skin. He bent down and picked up his bloody wet shirt and stood facing them, his rage gone, vulnerable again.
Maybe they could still be healed, Emma said. The Silent Brothers.
I don't need them healed, said Mark. They serve as a reminder. Julian slid off the table. A reminder of what?
Not to trust, said Mark.
Christina looked at Emma across the boys' heads. There was a terrible sadness on her face.
I'm sorry your protection rune failed you, Julian said, and his voice was low and careful, and Emma had never wanted to put her arms around him so much as she did then, as he faced his brother in the ocean-washed moonlight, his heart in his eyes. His hair was a tangle, his soft curls like question marks against his forehead. But there are other kinds of protection. Your family protects you. We will always protect you, Mark. We won't let them make you go back.
Mark smiled, the oddest, sad smile.
I know, he said. My gentle little brother, I know.
10. And she was a child. It's done, Diana said, tossing her duffel bag onto the kitchen island with a clanking sound. Emma looked up. She'd been over by the window with Christina, testing the bandages on her hands. Julian's healing runes had taken care of most of her injuries, but there were some ichor burns that were still sore. Livy, Drew, and Tavi were crowded around the kitchen table, fighting over who got the chocolate milk. Ty had his headphones on and was reading, calm in his own world. Julian was at the stove making bacon toast and eggs, with burnt bits in them, the way Drew liked. Diana went over to the sink and rinsed off her hands. She was in jeans and a t-shirt, dirt on her clothes and streaking her face. Her hair was pulled back in a tightly knotted bun.
You set it up? Emma asked. The monitor on the convergence?
Diana nodded, reaching for a dish towel to dry her hands.
Julian texted me about it. Did you think I was about to let you get out of the clave testing?
There were groans.
Thought no, said Emma. Hoped? Maybe.
Anyway, I did it myself, Diana said. If anyone goes in and out of that cave, we'll get a call on the Institute's phone.
And if we're not home? Julian asked.
Texts, Diana said, turning around so that her back was to the sink. Texts go to Julian, Emma, and myself.
Why not Arthur? Christina said. Does he not have a cell phone?
He didn't, as far as Emma knew, but Diana didn't answer that.
Now here's the other thing, she said. Manted demons guard the convergence during the night, but as you know, demons are inactive outside during the day. They can't stand sunlight.
I wondered, said Emma. It didn't make sense that whoever's doing this would leave the convergence unguarded for half the day.
You were right to wonder, Diana said. Her voice was neutral.
Emma searched her face in vain for a clue to whether she was still angry.
During the day, the door to the cave seals itself closed. I watched the entrance disappear when the sun rose. It didn't interfere with setting up the monitoring runes and wards. I did that outside the cave. But no one's going into that convergence while the sun's up.
All the murders, the body dumping, all of them have happened at night, Livy said. Maybe there's a demon behind this after all.
Diana sighed. We just don't know. By the angel, I need coffee.
Christina hurried to get her a mug, while Diana brushed at the dirt on her clothes, frowning.
Did Malcolm help set it up? Julian asked.
Diana took the coffee gratefully from Christina and smiled.
All you need to know is that it's taken care of, she said.
Now you've got testing today, so I'll see you in the classroom after breakfast.
She left, taking her bag and her coffee with her.
Drew looked glum.
I can't believe we have class, she said.
She was wearing jeans and a t-shirt that had a picture of a screaming face and the words Dr. Terror's House of Horrors across the front.
We're in the middle of an investigation, Livy said. We shouldn't have to take tests.
It's an affront, said Ty. I am affronted. He had pushed his headphones down, but his hand was under the table. She could hear him clicking a retractable pen. It was something he had done often before Julian had built him better focus tools, but it was still something he did when anxious. Against a background of grumbling from everyone, Emma's phone trilled. She glanced down and saw the screen flash. Cameron Ashdown. Julian looked over for a moment, then went briskly back to stirring the eggs. He was in a combination of gear, apron, and torn t-shirt that at another time would have had Emma teasing him. Now she just edged toward the window and picked up the call. "Cam," Emma said, "is something going on?" Livy looked over and rolled her eyes, then got up to start ferrying plates back and forth between the stove and the table. The rest of the kids were still arguing, though Tavi had wound up with the chocolate milk. "I didn't call to ask you to get back together, if that's what you're thinking," Cameron said. She pictured him as his voice came down the phone, frowning, his red hair messy and askew, as it always was in the morning. "Wow," said Emma. "Good morning to you, too." "Milk thief," Drew said to Tavi and put a piece of toast on his head. Emma stifled a smile. "I was at the shadow market," said Cam, "yesterday."
"Gasp! Shame on you."
"I heard some gossip around Johnny Rook's table," he said. "It was about you. He said he'd argued with you a few days ago." His voice lowered. "You shouldn't be seeing him outside the market, Em." Emma leaned back against the wall. Christina gave her a pointed look, then sat down with the others. Soon everyone was buttering toast and forking up eggs.
I know. Johnny Rook is a criminal who does crime. I got the lecture already."
Cam sounded put out.
"Someone else said you were poking your nose into something that wasn't any of your business, and that if you kept doing it, they'd hurt you. Not the guy who said it. I shook him down a little, and he said he meant someone else. That he'd heard things. What are you poking around in, Emma?"
Julian was still at the stove. Emma could tell by the set of his shoulders that he was listening.
"It could be so many things."
Cameron sighed. "Fine, be flip about it. I was worried about you. Be careful."
"Always am," she said, and hung up.
Silently, Julian handed her a plate of eggs. Emma accepted it, conscious that everyone was looking at her. She put the eggs down on the kitchen island and perched herself on one of the stools, poking at her breakfast with a spoon. "Okay," Livy said. "If no one else asks, I will. What was that about?" Emma looked up, about to give an annoyed answer, when the words died in her throat. Mark was standing in the doorway. The tension of last night's altercation in the library seemed to reappear, dropping a heavy silence over the kitchen. The Blackthorns looked at their brother, wide-eyed. Christina stared down at her coffee. Mark looked normal. He wore a clean blue Henley shirt and dark jeans that actually fit, along with a weapons belt around his waist, though there were no weapons in it. Still, it was unmistakably a shadow hunter belt, runes of angelic power and precision punched into the leather. There were gauntlets on his wrists. They all stared at him, Julian with his spatula in midair. Mark put his shoulders back, and for a moment Emma thought he was going to sweep another bow, the way he had last night. Instead, he spoke. "I apologize for yesterday evening," he said. "I should not have blamed you, my family. The politics of the Clave are complex and often dark, and not your fault. I would like to, with your permission, start over and introduce myself to you."
"But we know who you are," Ty said.
Livy leaned over and whispered in his ear, her hand brushing his shoulder. Ty looked back at Mark, clearly still puzzled, but also expectant. Mark took a step forward. "I am Mark Anthony Blackthorne," he said. "I come from a long line of proud shadow hunters. I have served with the Wild Hunt for years I cannot count. I have ridden through the air on a white horse made of smoke, and gathered up the bodies of the dead and brought them to Faerie, where their bones and skin have fed the savage land. I have never felt guilty, but perhaps I should." He let his hands, which had been clasped behind his back, fall to his sides. "I don't know where I belong," he said. "But if you let me, I will try to belong here." There was a moment of silence. The kids at the table stared. Emma sat with her spoon poised, holding her breath. Mark looked toward Jules. Julian reached up to rub the back of his neck.
"Why don't you sit down, Mark?" he said a little hoarsely. "I'll make you some eggs."
Mark was quiet all through breakfast as Julian, Emma, and Christina filled in the others on what they discovered the previous night. Emma kept the details of the Mantid attack minimal. She didn't want to give Tavi nightmares. Stanley Wells's wallet was passed over to Ty, who looked thrilled.